Hello. And let's see what we got here. I need the lights. Do this every year, but I have to sort of relearn the first day about Lowell. Okay, that's good. You can see that, right? I don't have any remote control. Okay, a lot of the information for this course is on our very extensive website, which we're very proud of. Gonna need batteries here. This is a picture of 2009's. I had trouble with my PowerPoint for transferring it from home last night at 1 a.m. And so this is last year's PowerPoint. You see 2009. This year's is different in that, would say, 2010. Otherwise, there's very little difference from the lectures I gave last year, but there is a difference, and I always... For the first lecture, they are all cosmetic, and none of the content is any different. Now, the website's very important for you because it's got constantly changing information. So you can see here announcements, which you should always be checking. Also, there's just a tremendous amount of content on this website, especially if you look at the... upper left, so I can rummage in here while I talk, where it says lectures. This is just a picture of it. So if you go in there, you'll have lecture notes for everything I'm saying now, almost. Not everything, but the gist of it. Very extensive lecture notes. In addition, this PowerPoint will be on there. Right? In addition, this audio will be on there. Right? And this year, I hope to have actually... for the first time trying it out, a combination of the PowerPoints, when we have PowerPoints in my lectures, we have PowerPoints and the audio combined, so you can just step through this whole lecture the same way I'm stepping through. We'll see if that works. I'm doing that in the evening. In the evening, there's another lecture, which is the same as this lecture, except I won't be... beset by all these technical problems. One more battery. In addition, you see handouts are on there, the handouts that you have now today. You should always pick up the handouts as you come into class because although today we won't be using them too much, most days it'll be handy for you to use your handouts, some of which will be reproduced as some of the PowerPoints, but even to take notes right on the handouts is a good idea. That's better. Things like your grades will be posted here, your exams as they come up. We have a couple of sample exams. There'll be under here an exam info page. The exams are very complicated to administer because there's so many of you and they're held in many rooms and at two times, as you'll see. So I recommend that you consult, you know, at least a few times a week this website. We made a very complete course description here, which is online, and better to read the online ones. The abbreviated form is one of your handouts today. We have about four times as big a the number of words. And so you should, if you have questions about the course, you should first consult that. And so I won't really take questions about the mechanics of the course today, but I will on Thursday. So go back. If you have any questions, see if you can answer it there. If not, raise your hand and ask your question next time. I won't take time to go through too much on the mechanics of the course, although I will spend some time right now talking about just that. So I already covered this. Now, the text you need for this course. The only text you really need is the problem book, which you can get at the Village Copier, which is described on the website. The problems, we feel, is about a few hundred problems for this course. We feel it's a problem-based course. We feel the problems is where you learn the material. I can stand up here and tell you about things, and you'll nod your heads and say, yes, that makes sense, or you'll scratch your head and say, it doesn't make sense. And you go back and you'll study it and you say, oh, now it makes sense. You have not learned it. You have not learned it until you can actually use the information that you get here. And the problems, most of them, not all of them, force you to use that information. So do the exams. Exams are like that. You'll be faced with having to use the information rather than just spit it back. That's not to say you don't need to be so familiar with the material that you don't know what the words mean. We try to minimize the memorization in this class and emphasize the use of the material. Nevertheless, we have to communicate with each other. Words and questions will mean something, and so you have to know what they mean. So the problem book is essential. The texts are two. One, because we cover the molecular material in this course, which is the emphasis of the course is sort of on molecules. And the levels of introductory texts are a little bit below what we use. We use mostly the biochemistry and molecular biology that's at the level of a cell biology book, where it's not actually a molecular biology course, but it's one up from introductory. And so we have this Becker text that we recommend. I would recommend it for most of the reading is to do the Becker text. Also very well written, that textbook. The other text is a general biology text, Sadava. We have a new edition this year. And it covers material that is mostly genetics and evolution that is not covered in the Becker text. So you could use both of these texts will be useful. The material that we are holding you responsible for, which is the material that we want you to learn, is the material presented in the lectures and that is present in the lecture notes in case a lecture gets... We don't finish something, this is rare, but there may be something in the lecture notes that's not covered in the lecture. So, and in my case, when I lecture, also the PowerPoint. So the PowerPoints, the lecture notes, and the spoken lecture is what you're responsible for. There's nothing in the book, in the two texts, except the problem book, nothing in the two texts that you will be that is not covered in a lecture that you would be responsible for. It's not to say it isn't important. Another way the texts are important is that what we give you here is sort of an edited, concise view of the story of life, if you will, that how things work. And so we take out the essential parts. What the book will do is tell you a lot more details, interesting cases that we don't cover in the short time we have to lecture. So when you read that, you sometimes get a better perspective and you understand the stuff we're talking about better for seeing the bigger picture that's presented in the text. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think it's true. For sure, the texts have beautiful pictures and diagrams. For instance, the PowerPoints I put up, or what Professor Moskowitz will introduce in a minute, puts up on the board, are simple stick diagrams, things like this. Occasionally, there's a photograph, but mostly for fun. Whereas the diagrams and the visual content in the book are very effective ways to learn, and they're beautifully done in both books and in any popular or even unpopular text that's available. So all this information you could get from other texts. You don't need the latest edition of Sadava, which is expensive. Get an older one, 8th edition. We give you the pagination of the suggested readings for the last edition as well, the 8th edition. Right? And in a way, you don't even need the pagination. That a good way to learn, in fact, is if there's something you don't understand about the lectures, go to the index. The indices are very extensive in these books. And look up what you want. You might find something else interesting while you're doing that. You might go to the wrong place, but then see something else. And it's also a good learning mechanism to use the index as a way to learn, much as you're all using, Googling things, right? So the text can be important, but, if you're strapped for funds, you don't really need to buy them. There's online text. All this is explained. I'm going into too much detail. All this is on the websites as well. Now, I've talked about the problem book, and let me talk about it again. You need the problem book. The problems are the heart of the course. So I repeat this for emphasis. You might say that if you can do the problems, that's how you're learning this material. But in order to do the problems, you have to come to and listen to the lectures. Well, do you really have to come to the lectures? I mean, after all, I'm going to be doing this. We have audio, and we have extensive lecture notes. So you could just sit home and maybe get to it, and don't come to class. Right. Then you'll miss, the only thing you'll miss is this body language. And which could be important, if I talk about something I'm very excited about, I might open my eyes wide and say, that's going to be on the exam. So I'd advise you to come to the lectures. The lecture notes are extensive, but they're not complete. When we first started using computer stuff for the course, and I went over to the Center for Learning, and they gave me a digital recorder, and I said, well, why don't you just read your lecture notes? That would be available, make that available for the students instead of recording it. So I went down to my basement, where it was quiet. It's a finished basement, it was nice. And I read my lecture notes with great feeling and emphasis and modulation of my pitch and amplitude of my voice, just as I might do right here in the lecture. And then the 75-minute lecture took about 27 minutes. So you see, I'm kind of long-winded when I actually give the lecture. That means I'm saying things twice, like the problem book. Even in my one sentence after another, I'm not efficient. When you write, you make it very efficient and concise. So maybe you come to the lecture, you waste a lot of time hearing these extra words like these I'm saying right now. But on the other hand, if you hear it twice and you hear it a slightly different way, that helps, I think. So I'm not so upset that it takes me 75 minutes to deliver 27 minutes worth of material. If you have questions, we have two ways you can get information that you didn't understand from the lecture. One, and the most important, is the recitation sections. Now, we have two classes here, C205 and F2401. There might be students from both mixed in. Mostly, and we have two times the lectures given, now and at 5:40. The lectures are almost identical. You can come to either lecture. I don't care what you're signed up for, what section you're signed up for, it's no different. If you want to sleep late, come to the evening lecture. You want to hear it twice, come to both lectures. It's a little crazy. So we have recitations for both. In F2401, which is the course designed for School of General Studies, post-baccalaureate students mostly, although some are baccalaureate students also. In any case, they're older students. That has sections that are optional, and you can go or you not go. For C205 students, college students, then you have to go to the recitations. We make sure you have to go because there are quizzes there. Recitations will start next week. Quizzes won't start till the week after that. This week, you should be signing up for one of our 13 or so different recitation sections, which are handled mostly by students who took the course before, and they generally get better reviews than lecturers do. So they are very good, these TAs, and they're very dedicated and enthusiastic. So that's one way to get questions. The other is to come to the office hours of the instructors, which are not many, but two a week, 2 hours, or three, and come and ask your questions. That time is set aside by the instructors, me in this case for now, for you to come and ask your questions. I really enjoy it when you come and I can talk one-on-one instead of one-to-many like this and get feedback and we have a conversation rather than a lecture. So don't hesitate to come to office hours. I set that aside of time. I expect you to come And if there's a group of you, it's still more informative, maybe, than getting your questions answered than sitting in a big group like this. Then there's a Q&A database. Well, let me go to email. You can email us. We will respond to your email. We will respond quickly, unless at one time, at four times during the year, we won't respond quickly, and that's when your questions come right before an exam, because we're very busy preparing the exam, and we get other people at the last minute asking questions. So the only time I feel bad that I don't get to answer a question is at that time. So don't leave your questions until 24 hours before the exam. Otherwise, you will get a prompt response, and your response will be try to be a little different than it was presented in lecture, because obviously that didn't work for you. So we'll give you a personalized answer. If we like that question and we like our answer, we will publish that question and answer. And we've been doing this for umpteen years, such that we now have a database which is searchable by exam number, by year, by keyword, most important thing. And we have like over 1,000 questions in there. So it's like another book, except it's just all these little questions, not organized. Lectures are the same. Recitation sign-up I talked about. There's a sign-up form on the website, which you should use. Thursday night at midnight is the deadline, because on Friday we'll assign the sections, hopefully. And then Monday night is the first section. So we need to get it certainly done by Monday morning. Please note the exam dates. We will drop the lowest exam, except for the final. Final will count half. We try to make the course transparent. So if you have any question about how things are done, how grades are given, I think it's all explained. We try to make it completely open. Nothing hidden. The exam topics are not too different than what's in the problem book, and especially the start questions in the problem book came from old exams. I don't know if I'm going to have time to do this. This is an adaptation from something called Bloom's Taxonomy, which is the way students learn, or different levels at which you can learn. So this is sort of our attitude. Our attitude is that if you just memorize the stuff. We emphasize this because you might have had this kind of training in your high school, right? And in like in an AP course, maybe even especially, that you need to be able to answer these questions on an exam. And so you have to know what this means, and when they ask you what it means, you can say, this is what it means. If you just do that, you will not be able to pass this course. If you cannot just spit back what you heard, but paraphrase it, show that you understand sort of what it means, in your own words, which is better than just repeating something you memorized, then you could pass, but you won't get a good grade. Right? What you have to do is show that you can apply what you learn, that you understand what it means because you can use it. If you can use it, it shows us and it shows yourself that you can, that you have integrated the material into your brain. Right? You understand it. So the exams and the problems, we try to give you new situations. We didn't learn about this. We didn't learn about life on Mars. Suppose there's life on Mars and such and such. We didn't learn about that. That's how we try to think up exams like that. We do it for many years. We write new exams every year. Questions are getting by now a little similar, but nevertheless, they're made from scratch, although with our own memory of our old, but we don't, copy. So we try to think up situations which are challenging and which test the your ability to use the information you have and almost to discourage the use of memorized material. Like you might say, then you may call it, oh, it's tricky, because I know this is so I just say this. But in fact, we're looking for something else. We're trying to, if you just give it automatically the memorized material, it could trap you, trick you up. Why do we know what it means? Do we do that out of meanness? No. We have a certain reputation by now for these exams. If you know that this is what the exam is going to be like, you're going to have to study to pass that kind of exam. And you'll have to study in order to be able to do the problems. And that's what we're after. We use the exams
as a learning tool for you. So you're forced, if you want a good grade, you're forced to study and learn the material in this way. And the only way to do it is to do the problems. The problems, if you do the problems, that's the center. You can use the lectures to be able to help you do the problems. You can use the text to help you understand the lectures. And that's sort of the hierarchy. So now you can get an A if you did that. If you can actually think up new things yourself, that's sort of the ultimate, using the information you have. We don't really expect that. But if you do it, some of you will do that. But we don't really test for that. That's the one. Okay, so that's all the mechanics. My goodness. Now let's start on the material of the course. So what is biology? Let's see if I covered everything. All right. Biology is understanding how living things work. That's my definition. Understanding how living things work. So what's in that phrase? There's two things. There's the living things. What are living things? We'll get to it. What about understanding? Understanding is kind of a subjective concept, right? What I consider understanding, another person would not. If I say, I understand how a cell divides, a physicist may say, well, do you really understand it? It doesn't satisfy me. I want to know where the electrons are. So it is somewhat subjective. But nevertheless, I think we can find some common ground. The basis of all science is that you have an idea, you have an hypothesis of explaining something, and then you do an experiment which tests that idea, and the experiment, say, disproves the idea was wrong, right? Or is consistent with the idea, so it could be right. It's easy to disprove something, not so easy to prove something. Nevertheless, if you do enough experiments and each one comes out consistent with your result, you begin to believe it, and then after a while you do believe it. So what do we believe about relationships? What I believe, what I have confidence in, maybe for not great reason, but I believe that 2 and 2 equals 4. Because I've done that experiment many times. And it always comes out 4. At least with our current numbering system. So, for me, a mathematical, and for many scientists, a mathematical prediction is sort of the purest and the most unquestionable and easy to feel that you understand something if you have a mathematical relationship. So now you move from mathematics and apply it to nature. So physics. Physics, the study of the forces of the universe. And we have Newton here with his apple. And he provided us with some understanding of the forces of gravity, the forces between two objects. He could quantify it. He could write equations that would predict how fast that apple would be running when it's halfway down its descent from the branch to the ground, or three-quarters of the way. Right? So he could derive a mathematical relationships that could explain nature, the natural world. Doesn't say we actually understand gravity even today, but went a long way towards just looking at the apple and saying, that's nice. He understands some forces were at work here. You can move from physics into something I would call chemical physics and start studying the nature rather than just the forces, the matter of the world, which is the subject of chemistry. So here's a hydrogen atom, here's its nucleus, and here's a depiction of that one electron in many different positions, sort of a composite picture in time, of the probability density of an electron, right? Mostly around here, but sometimes out here. And you can describe that probability with this much more complicated equation, describing the position of an electron at any moment, the probability it will be a certain distance from the nucleus, the Schrodinger equation. So we can make very complicated mathematical relationships. we go more into pure chemistry and a little bit away from physics, we can predict that if you have a structure like this that's got a C double bond here and an OH here, that you can lose water from such a structure. And you can predict that if you have such a structure and you add a base or you add an acid to it, you will get a chemical reaction that takes place. And all that's because of where the electrons are relative to the nuclei in these compounds. And could be explained. And so you have feeling, you understand how this takes place. Chemists understand this. They feel they understand it. Because they understand the structure of the molecule, the electronic structure of the molecule. The electronic structure is based on the physics of these small particles, right? Atoms. And the physics is based on the math. So we have this hierarchy. So there's also in chemistry something, you have products of reaction and reactants. In biology, this is an important thing because chemistry is going on within us all the time. And in biology, we also have mathematical relationships. Does this look very complicated? Actually, it's not that complicated. It's not the Schrodinger equation. It's more like Newton's equation. This equation that we use in biology and that you will use in this course. Equations describing the directionality and the extent to which a biochemical reaction, a reaction that's happening inside your body, moves in one direction or another direction. So we can apply math directly to biology, and we can also feel that if we can explain biology, which we do mostly, in terms of chemistry, then we have that link to physics and to math, and we feel we're understanding it. Okay, this was very long-winded. So we're going to present biology mostly from a chemical point of view. Now we are a walking compendium of chemicals, and that understanding those chemical reactions understands a lot towards what is life. Right? So we ask you to have a firm grounding in chemistry before you take this course. Might be a few of you here who have not had college chemistry. If you had a good, solid high school chemistry course that you remember, that would probably be sufficient, because we're going to be talking about these kinds of concepts without explaining them. So we're assuming one ordinary year of, or even a semester, of college chemistry. Something about structure and bonding, ions, you can read this as well as I won't take time. Along with this chemistry, we need some math. You have to be easy with exponents, or obtain that easiness by as you go through problems. Logarithms, you'll have to use them. Simple algebra, no quadratic equations probably, but moving constants and variables around to solve for solutions, you'll need algebra. You do not need calculus, even though it's useful in a few isolated cases here, but not at all necessary. So this chemistry will be mostly presented during the first half of the course, when we cover biochemistry, we start out with, and then we move on to something called molecular biology, and then genetics. So molecular biology is sort of biochemistry from one step away. And during the first half of the course, we'll talk in terms of chemical structures, mostly organic chemical structures, but organic chemistry is not required. And you'll learn the organic chemistry as we go along. It's not a course in chemistry. We're not going to be talking a lot about mechanism of these chemical reactions, but just trying to provide a feeling that what's happening inside living things is reasonable in terms of chemistry, is explicable in terms of chemistry. And that's a major driving force in the course. So I'll be teaching all of that part, and then when we move to molecular biology, and then genetics and a little of evolution, the course will be taken over by Professor Deborah Moshowitz, who is standing in the back of the room in the purple shirt, and she will take over lecture 10, and I'll give 9 lectures. And we sort of collaborate on the exams. Okay, let's talk about then understanding living things. I went on and on about understanding. Now let's talk about what are living things. And I have a short definition. You can get up to 7 in some books. And we can argue about, you know, whether a virus is a living thing or not. And it's sort of interesting, but in the end, not that interesting. I had a student arguing that, well, let me talk about these characteristics first, and I'll tell you what was proposed last year. First of all, living things have a complex structure. And they're compared to what? Compared to non-living things. What's a non-living thing? It's like a rock or the air, right? So, or an ice cube. You look at an ice cube, one molecule arranged in a nice crystal structure. You look at a rock, many different kinds of atoms, perhaps. You might have a fancy striated rock with gold and sapphire and whatever mixed in, but you're still down to a few molecules and arranged in a very orderly way, if you could look at them and you consider them at the atomic level. Whereas biological structures are complex, and we'll go more into this. Metabolism. The rock pretty much just sits there, might get eroded over a million years a little bit, whereas living things are in a constant dynamic flux with their environment, right? You breathe in, you breathe out. Stuff going on just then, right? You eat, you excrete. They have, you're constantly interacting with the environment in a chemical way. And finally, this complex structure, which is interacting dynamically with the environment, the whole ball of wax here is reproduced almost exactly. And you get another thing doing the same thing. So these are my three characteristics that distinguish living things from non-living things. Right. So, sort of somewhat uninteresting. It's interesting if you have, a beer or two in an armchair to discuss whether fire satisfies this requirement. Right? Because you could argue, maybe that's what I got last year. Right? I was polite. Let's draw an example of this. Here we have two rubber plants. Actually, one is not a real rubber plant. It's one you buy in a store, which you never have to water, and it's an artificial rubber plant. So what's the difference? One is not a living thing. It's just some plastic. And the other is this living thing. So what about the complexity of these two? Which one is which? You can't tell by looking at them from this point of view. On the left, we have this artificial rubber plant. It's got in it some different molecules. It's got polypropylene, which is a plastic, right? Polyester, which is sort of another plastic. It might have 5 different dye molecules to make up these different shades of green and brown. It looks very realistic, with the brown edges to look as if it's crying for water, right? So maybe 7 different molecules. Molecules that are defined by molecular structure, one type of molecule. Right? 7. How about the real guy? Real guy has about 20,000. This is a minimum. It's really more like 100,000, but I choose to use 20,000 as for molecules that are doing the main jobs of life. 20,000 different molecules, each doing a job. So it's much more complicated. And these molecules are arranged in very orderly ways, much of them, many of them, in a very orderly, organized way. Each one doing a job, as I said. There's 20,000 jobs to keep this guy alive. Right? And plus you have to water it, right? How about 2, the chemical interaction with the environment. This real plant is taking up the water that you give it. It's taking up fertilizing chemicals you're giving it, like nitrates, right? It's taking up CO2, and does photosynthesis from the environment, and it's giving off oxygen. So it's doing a lot. Every minute. Whereas you see no such interaction with this artificial plant. I don't tell too many jokes, but I just have a humor embedded. Like that. How about reproduction? This guy cannot reproduce. This guy can make a whole bunch of other little rubber plants, except for the pot. So that whole business reproduced. So that puts a little visual aid in our three characteristics of life. So if this is true for all of life, how is this complex? How are all these molecules made? How are they organized into in a way that helps them do their jobs? And how do they? And how does the whole organism reproduce? So we can take two different approaches to finding out how. One is to look at differences between how, let's say, a real rubber plant does it, and how, say, a human being does it. Look completely different, right? So they might learn something about the differences between these two living things. It might be useful. For instance, this looking at differences is what Darwin did. That was his approach. He looked at differences in the structure of beaks, for example, among other things he did, of certain finch birds, right? And from that, he could determine, you know, that these will be able to crack big seeds, and these will be able to get in and get little seeds from hidden places. And this helped him to formulate this idea of the evolution of life, a very all-important concept, by studying differences. We're not going to proceed that way. We're going to take the opposite tack. We have all these different kinds of organisms, the panoply of life, so diverse, so wonderful in its diversity, from little microorganisms to big horses, right? Is it possible that they all have a common denominator, that they all solve these basic problems of how to synthesize lots of different, thousands of different chemicals that do jobs, and how they do these jobs, how you interact with the environment, and how you reproduce? Is it possible they all do it the same way? The short answer is yes. They all do it the same way, even though they look so diverse. This is called reductionism. We reduce the problem to its simplest fundamental aspects. This course is a reductionist course. We're reducing biology to its basic concepts and processes. And sometimes reductionism is given a bad word, but we wear the badge proudly. Reductionism has been very successful in the last 50 years in explaining how living things works in terms of chemistry, starting in the late 50s. So, if all life works the same way, basically, if we're going to study it, let's study maybe the simplest form of life. Why study, you know, a rubber plant, which is sort of complicated with roots and leaves, or human beings, you know, with fingernails and livers. So what's the basic unit of life? Well, let's take an analogy from chemistry. Basic unit in chemistry is the molecule. If we take corn syrup, let's say, which is mostly glucose, molecule glucose. If we take a cc of corn syrup and taste it, it tastes sweet. And if we take a thousandth of that and stick it in our tongue, we still might be able to see that it tastes sweet. And in fact, in theory, you could take one molecule of glucose in the corn syrup. If you hit a receptor with it, it only takes one molecule to hit your brain and say, hey, this is sweet. I know something about this molecule. It gives off a sweet taste. So you can break this corn syrup down. As long as you have one intact glucose molecule, you have its certain characteristic. But once you break the bond in this and make it not glucose, but two other smaller molecules, which I won't bother to name now, although we'll talk about them later, two different molecules, it's no longer sweet. It's lost its identity as a molecule. So in chemistry, the molecule is the basic unit of chemistry. Let's do this experiment in people, in a living organism. We'll take a person. Is that person alive by these three criteria? Well, it's obvious. It's alive. Suppose you take a little piece of this person, cut off a little piece of the skin, put it in a petri dish, surround it with like blood-like, what it's being bathed with in your body, the blood. You give it some fake blood, which is everything blood has and more, and ask, is it alive? Well, if you let it sit there for a week or so, you find in this growth medium, we'll call it, medium is what the liquid is called, that started out small, ended up big. It grew. And if you look at the structure of this thing, under a powerful microscope, you see it's a very complicated, organized structure. And if you did a chemical analysis of this, you'd find 20,000 different molecules, just like the rubber plant. And in here you find the same thing, and it's bigger. So the reproduction thing was going on here, and it's complicated, and it's and you measure, let's say, what's happening to this medium. You see, stuff is being taken up. Some molecules are being taken up, like glucose. Others are being given off, like carbon dioxide. So it's alive. That piece of skin is alive. Now we shake it apart. We shake it apart gently, but for a long time, in a nice salt solution that, again, simulates blood in some way, so that the tissue here is happy. You get it down to these small but not so small particles, and then it doesn't get any smaller. And then these are called, you look at them under the microscope, you see there's these units all about the same size. These are cells. So all the tissue is made up of all these balls, spheres, which are cells. And inside the cell is a very complicated structure still. And you take one cell and you do, if you could, and you do, actually you can nowadays, you look for how many different molecules there are in each cell, you still get your 20,000, even in each cell. So are they alive? Well, how about reproduction? Well, you take one cell out, put it in the growth medium again, come back a week later, and you have a million cells. Well, 1,000 cells. So they're growing. I mean, they're reproducing. The cells are reproducing. So that cell, that single cell, is alive. Still alive. Let's keep going. Now let's put them in a blender. So the cells even are broken up. Now you have little cell pieces of cells. Right? So you look at these pieces of cells under the microscope, still pretty organized. I mean, nice structures. You look at how many molecules a given piece would have, still has maybe thousands, maybe not 20,000, but still has at least hundreds of different molecules, right? But and do these pieces then satisfy the third requirement? Oh, and you look at interaction with the environment. Yes, there's much less, but still you can detect something's going on with these particles, right? Subcellular particles. But if you try to grow them, they don't. They just stay there forever. Right? You don't get any more particles from these particles. It fails the last test. It's not alive. It's dead. Killed by the blender. So we back up and say, this is our unit of life, cells. And we can give somebody's quote, I don't know, for a cell theory. All living things are made up of cells by observation, right? Or cells might secrete some material on the outside that's sort of part of you, right? Like your hair, and dead cells. Right? And all cells come from other cells by this reproduction. So, what is a cell? The real topic of cell biology will be covered in the second semester. In most introductory texts, at this point, there's a chapter on cells, chapter 5 in Sadhava, for example. And it tells you all about the cell. I give you a very simple abbreviated form of that. Right? First, maybe most importantly, a cell is surrounded by a cell membrane, and sometimes called a plasma membrane, the historical term. And inside this membrane is the cytoplasm. And outside the cell, depends on the situation. It could just be that growth medium in the experiment we did. So one maybe primary use of this membrane is to define the cell. The cell is the membrane and everything inside of it, and the rest of the world is outside. So you have a geographic function of this membrane. Within the cytoplasm, if we're taking these skin cells, face of a human, you will find a nucleus where information in the form of DNA, which we'll get to in a couple of months, is stored in a skin cell, let's say, from a human. And then there's another membrane, different from this membrane, with some similarities, that delineates and defines this nucleus inside the cell. Then inside the cytoplasm, you see other membranes and other big particles that are made up maybe of hundreds of molecules all organized together in some complicated structure. And these are called organelles. So this is now our more complicated picture. We're just going to add one more thing. to this generalized cell picture. Oh, first, the organelles might be called things like mitochondria. What's that? Right. I'm assuming you know no biology. Lysosomes, what's that? Ribosomes, what's that? Etc. Some have membranes, some do not. At this point in chapter 5 in Sadhava, they will tell you what the mitochondria do. They will tell you what the ribosome does. No point, seems to me, to tell you that now, because it doesn't mean very much to you. I say, ribosomes are necessary for protein synthesis. So, okay, but you don't understand it until you understand how protein synthesis works, which we'll go into in excruciating detail. Then we'll talk about the ribosomes. Mitochondria are necessary for energy metabolism. We'll talk about energy metabolism in excruciating detail. You'll appreciate what the mitochondria is. So we skipped the whole chapter on cell biology at this point. But we have to talk about the cell, so I give you this very minimalist view of the cell. One more aspect to it. This membrane is not this simple, a simple structure, but it's rather very variegated. It has channels in it because stuff has to get in, stuff has to get out. Some of these channels have pumps associated with them to make sure you pump in the right stuff and pump out the wrong waste material. And also sensors to know what kind of environment you're in so you can respond appropriately. Now there's the stuff going in and out or being pumped in and out. And here's a sensor detecting a molecule on the outside world and then doing something when it senses an outside world. This message gets transmitted to here. That you'll learn about in cell biology using the principles you'll learn in this first semester course. So there's our cell picture. How big is that cell? The skin cell is about 10 micrometers or microns in diameter. Usually with mu, but I have trouble with that font. So you can say UM for micrometer. How big is that? Well, let's talk about some sizes now because we're going to use these sizes. This is the first time I've introduced sizes. We all know a millimeter, right? It's about the head of a pin. If you have the right kind of ruler, you can see it. You can easily detect it with your eyes, at least you can. And if we go down 1,000-fold, we get to the micron, which is the unit or micrometer that we're talking about here, a millionth of a meter now. And that you can't see, but you can easily see, and you can just about see that actually under a light microscope. And this is microns is the size of cells, except maybe some nerve cell is 2 feet long, but still not very wide. It's of the order of microns, 10 microns, 30 microns for human being cells. While we're talking about it, let's take it down another 1,000-fold. We get into molecules. Nanometers, NM, which is a billionth of a meter and 1,000th of a micron. You can't see that in a microscope. It's too small. And so it's of the order of diameter of molecules. Like water is about half a nanometer. That glucose molecule is about 1.5 micrometers because it's kind of all balled up. And finally, you go down one more level. Instead of 1,000, it's just 1/10, because it doesn't pay for us in chemistry to talk about anything less than this. 1/10 of a nanometer, sometimes called, is called the angstrom, and it's less used today, but you still see it used. And it's generally the distance between atoms that's good for. That's good within the molecule. So it's a handy unit for that. So. The smallest cells you can find in nature are about 1 micron. Now, I told you that the skin cell is 10 microns. Is that 10 times bigger? No. That's 1,000 times bigger because we're talking about 3 dimensions here. So if you think of it most easily as a little cube, this is 10 microns on a side or 1,000 cubic microns, whereas the smallest cells are only 1 micron on a side or 1 cubic micron. So what are these smallest cells? So on a scale for where I showed you the human skin cell, this is now about 1/10 its diameter, and that's our smallest cell, which is a bacterial cell. Remember what we're doing here. We're trying to find the simplest unit of life so we can focus on that to study, because it'll be simpler. Here's a bacterial cell. Single is called a bacterium. Let's blow it up. The bacterial cell has a cell membrane, just like the skin cell did, but it's more complicated actually in a way because it's got this hard case around it, which protects it from harsh environments like the ground or sewers. So there's a hard cell wall as opposed to a membrane. It's usually fairly permeable, but it's more of a structural component for the cell. So in that sense, it's more complicated. On the other hand, let's see what I have here. You notice that I didn't draw a nucleus in here because there is no nucleus where the DNA is. DNA is just right out there in the cytoplasm in bacteria. There's millions or at least tens of thousands of different kinds of bacteria. And they're very small, but there's so many of them that they add up to a tremendous mass, represent a lot of the total mass on Earth of living things. They don't have any membrane-bound organelles. In fact, they're smaller than those mitochondria and lysosomes that we saw inside the skin cell and passed over so quickly. So in that sense, they're simpler. They have DNA, they have no nucleus and no organelles to worry about. Another simplification is if you study bacteria, and you can have, a billion bacteria in a test tube, because they're so small, you could analyze them, measure something about them, how much nitrogen atoms do they have in them, right? Since they're all just one cell in the whole organism, this is called a unicellular organism. The skin cell was part of this more complex structure, in that case called a human being. It was only one little kind of cell, maybe 200 or 300 different kinds of cells in a human being. The skin cell was only one. If you grind up these billion bacteria and you make some measurement, then you can divide by the number of cells and you say that's the amount of DNA there is per cell, that's the amount of sugar per cell, whatever. If you grind up a human being and do that, then you're not sure what tissue was contributing more or contributing less. So the homogeneity of these populations of cells that we study chemically is another advantage for studying a small, simple cell. Cells that have a nucleus are called eukaryotes. Kary means like a nut in Greek, and U is true. They have a true nut right in the middle of them. Whereas prokaryotes don't. They're previous to that, maybe, although we're not sure about that. So bacteria are prokaryotes. There are other kinds of prokaryotes, but we'll talk mostly about bacteria. And now we can start to talk about the organization of all living things a little bit. Let's start with these simple ones, the prokaryotes, which are both prokaryotic and unicellular, right? These are mostly bacteria. There are some other kinds which we won't talk about. And I'll give you some examples. Pneumococcus. This is a pathogen, right? You can get pneumonia, viral pneumonia, not viral pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia from such things. Luckily, you can take an antibiotic, cure you of that. You might have rhizobium. That's another bacterium. It lives in the roots of certain kinds of plants, helps them to fix nitrogen out of the air, so they can, in a usable form, the plant can use, so they don't need so much fertilizer. That's a very useful bacterium. Another is Escherichia coli, which is, you hear about in the newspaper sometimes, giving you trouble, but in fact, it's a big help to us because it's the most popular laboratory model of living cells, which is actually what we're after. We'll talk mostly about E. coli in this course. How about unicellular but eukaryotes with a nucleus? Are any of those? Yeah, there's plenty of those. Some you may be familiar with if you ever, in your grade school, looked at pond water and saw all these things crawling around in it, the amoeba, paramecia swimming around. Those are big cells, even bigger than the skin cells. They have a nucleus, but it's a unicellular organism. Right? So it has that homogeneity aspect, but they're very complicated cells, little mouths and things. Some cause disease, like Plasmodium. Others are useful, like yeast, which helps us make beer, wine, bread. Also in the lab, a terrific model organism if you want to study eukaryotes. Still unicellular, so it has all those advantages. How about multicellular prokaryotes? Some of these bacteria get together and form something with tissues and whatever. Very few examples. Don't care to dwell on. How about multicellular organisms that are eukaryotic, have the nucleus? Well, these are the ones that are out in the world that you see, like a human being, a worm, a fruit fly, a fish, a plant. All of these, a mouse, all of these are popular research organisms. Of course, there are also tigers and elephants and athlete's foot. Sorry, athlete's foot is probably down here. I'm not sure. Okay, we're going to study E. coli. What's E. coli? Escherichia coli, named for Dr. Escher, more familiarly called E. coli. Here's how it grows. Let's get to the reproduction part. You have this 1 micron guy, gets twice as big as you give him growth medium, and when he gets to about twice as big, a little more, a little less, it divides by binary fission, and you get 2 E. coli. So there's the reproduction of E. coli. That whole business takes an hour. If you give it what's called a minimal medium, if you get just the stuff it needs and able to let it grow, nothing extra. And we'll talk about what that medium is in a minute. So in this very simple medium, you can get from one bacteria to 2 in about an hour. So that's, you know, faster than our generation time. What's going on here? We have this cell that begins with a certain amount of stuff in it, which is blue. And then it gets bigger, so it has to make more stuff. So let's label the stuff that's made as it gets twice as big in red. They're both the same kinds of molecules. How many different kinds of molecules? Well, it's not 20,000 anymore. This is a simple organism. It's about 5,000. Still up there, thousands. Right? Thousands of different molecules. Right? So we just have more of them here. Then it divides, and they pretty much get divided equally. So you have some of the old stuff and some of the stuff that was made during this 1 hour. In the whole E. coli, there's maybe 10 million molecules. These are very rough numbers. Could be easily off by a factor of 5. Of 5,000 different types, right? So you might have 3 molecules of one type, and then 157 molecules of another type. Right? Altogether, 10 million molecules of 5 different structures, which defines what the molecule is, like that uncleaved glucose molecule. How many molecules do we have here? If we had 10,000 molecules in one, we're going to have 20,000 molecules in 2 cells. What types of molecules are you going to have here? Well, same 5,000 types. So we have this E. coli, it's the same as that E. coli. We reproduce the whole thing. But now we just have more of them. Most of these molecules are organic molecules. What does that mean? Organic molecule is simply a molecule that contains carbon. Most of the molecules that do jobs in our cells are large molecules that have carbon in them. So we'll be talking mostly about organic chemistry here, the chemistry of carbon-containing molecules. There are surely other molecules, a few other molecules in the cell that don't contain carbon, like salts, like sodium, ions, and things like this. And we talk about them from time to time. But from the interesting point of view of what's happening here is this job. There's a net increase in this 1 hour of 10 million organic molecules, each with its, of 5,000 types, each with their own particular structure, synthesized in 1 hour. What are these 5,000 molecules? Our job will be to talk about that in the weeks to come. We won't mention all 5,000. But we'll mention hundreds by the time we're done, and they'll be representative. And whence do they come? How do you get these new red molecules? Where are they coming from? Thin air? No, can't come from thin air. That wouldn't be chemistry. That wouldn't be science. The newly synthesized stuff must be coming from the growth medium, the stuff that's in the growth medium. Since it can't come from thin air. Here's one particular formulation of a minimal growth medium for E. coli. It's got that glucose molecule I showed you in corn syrup. This is just the abbreviated formula for it. It shows proportion of all the molecules, of all the atoms in the molecule. So You'll notice that's the only organic molecule in this growth medium, the only one containing carbon, just glucose. We have a source of inorganic molecules like potassium and phosphate, both of which are needed, and you can provide them both by adding potassium phosphate. We need magnesium, we need sulfur, we can do that with magnesium sulfate, nitrogen, ammonium chloride, etc., and we need water. Then there's trace elements, tiny amounts of zinc, and selenium, things like that. These are the main components. And this is the only organic molecule. We have to make 5,000, for E. coli, 5,000 different molecules out of that. This is what glucose looks like. Again, it has a particular structure. We're going to have to make 5,000 different things coming from that. So it follows that these 5,000 different organic molecules have to come from glucose in some way, because it's the only source of carbon, and organic molecules have carbon. So essentially, you can make a whole new E. coli cell net from glucose with some salt, I'll grant you, in 1 hour. So I had this I had this picture of glucose up on my is that the next one or not? I think it's not in this one. No. On my screen a few years ago, working on this lecture, my father-in-law looked over my shoulder and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, this is glucose." He said, "You know, you can get a whole, you can build a whole E. coli cell with just using glucose, essentially." Right? He said, "Wow, that's amazing. You can make an E. coli cell from glucose?" I said, "Yes, you know, so I'm quite impressed by this, right?" And he said, "Well, how do you do it? What kind of a special, you know, apparatus do you use?" I said, "Oh," he said, "you just put in some glucose and some salts, and you put in one E. coli cell, and then you can get..." "What, you have to put in an E. coli cell?" I said, "Well, yes." He said, "Oh, I thought you were actually constructing a living cell from glucose," right? Because he reads the Tuesday Times, and he's always impressed by biotechnology, and he thought we had advanced to that point. I said, "Well, no, we can't do that yet. Maybe not ever, but..." "But if we start with one E. coli, the E. coli can do it." He says, "Well, okay." That's it. Walked away. He wasn't so impressed, because he's used to it. He's used to this idea that cells grow and reproduce all the time, right? Like, you know, your kids start to grow up, and you see every year a couple inches. In May, you have to mow the lawn twice a week. You leave a peach in the refrigerator, looks fine. The next morning, big piece of mold the size of a quarter on it. Right? Growth. We take it for granted. We can't put glucose in, tear it apart, make all these molecules, put them together and make an E. coli cell. But E. coli can do it. It does it in 1 hour, with no computers, with no brain. How's that work? That's what he should have been curious about, in my opinion. That's what you should be curious about, and if you're not curious about it, then you're not going to have fun in this course. This is our logo. Two cells from one. How's that work? Well, to know what we have to make, to know what the job is, we have to know what it is we have to do. What is the task? What kinds of molecules are present? So this is just a little preview, because we're going to go into this in detail as the semester goes on. We can talk about the organic molecules of E. coli have to be made. There's four here that are called large molecules, and they're sort of polymeric molecules made up of small units. There's polysaccharides made of sugars, lipids, made of various things, nucleic acids, and proteins. So we have these four categories, and we'll step through them one by one during this course of the first 2 months of the course. And then there's these small molecules, similar to like glucose, the ones that are in the minimal medium, ammonium chloride, whatever. So that's our job, is to make all these. How do we get these chemicals? Well, our only source of these four guys, which all contain carbon, is from glucose. And we do it via chemical reactions, called synthetic reactions, because we're making something, biosynthetic, because it's taking place inside the cell. And this is called metabolism, or sometimes intermediary metabolism. So this is a lot of what's going on in life. All this takes energy, which we'll talk about in detail. Where does the energy come from? Do we have to put this minimal medium in sunlight or zap it with electricity? No. It comes from glucose again. Some subset of metabolism called energy metabolism, which extracts energy from the glucose molecule for running all these myriad chemical reactions. Finally, how does E. coli know how to do this? Well, the information for it is in the DNA. We'll talk about that too. Dr. Moshowitz will start that part of the course. Information is hardwired right into the DNA. As long as you have that DNA molecule inside that cytoplasm in the simple cell, the program is written, and it will make everything it needs to do in order to make a new E. coli cell over and over again. So, we have our glucose running through biosynthetic pathways in this tree-like thing, making many different other small molecules that are no longer glucose, but are something else, and might have things besides carbon in them, as they get synthesized, and then these are you put together to form these macromolecules. This is just a preview overview. Often I'll try to remember to direct you to a handout when it's important. In this case, in this first lecture, they're kind of general and not so important. And even this one, which is the exponential growth handout, I think it's not the kind of thing you can you'd probably be useful in class. It's the kind of thing that you should read slowly and carefully when you at your leisure, at your convenience. What about this growth? Before we go into the chemistry of it, let's think a little bit about the mathematics of it. You have one cell getting bigger for E. coli, divides by binary fission, and you get two. I said I was interested in mathematical relationships, so we're going to derive one right here. We probably won't finish it in 3 minutes I have left. So this was one generation before, and you made two cells out of that one generation. The next generation, we have these two cells dividing, you get four cells. After three generations, you're going to have, you already know, eight cells, and then 16 cells, 32, 64, right? You keep doubling. So just by observation, you can see, you can write a relationship that 2 to the 1 is after one generation, 2 to the 2 generations gives 4, 2 to the 3 generations gives 8, and in general, the number of cells is, if you start with one cell, you'll have 2 to the G, which G is just short for generations, the number of doublings the cells go through. Let's make this a little more general. Suppose we start now with one cell, but 100 cells. So then after one generation, you have 200, and after three generations, you have 800. So in this case, N equals 100 times 2 to the G, or in general, whatever number you start with, which we can call N naught. So now this is in red because it's a general formula. The number of cells at any given moment is the number of cells you started with times 2 to the number of generations that have elapsed since you started with N-naught cells. But number of generations is not such a useful number. We'd rather have time instead of generations. So we can define G, number of generations, as the time that's gone by divided by some constant, which is the doubling time. And that'll depend on the organism and on the medium you give it. Right? So for E. coli in minimal medium, and if the units are hours, then this TD would be 1. Right? Or if it's minutes, it would be 60. Right? And the number of time that goes by. So we can rewrite this equation now. As N equals N naught, that D is a little big, right? 2 to the T over T sub D, that should be. It was so small, then I made it too big. Or, if we don't like this fraction in the exponent, we can do a further definition of K, some kind of growth constant, as 1 over TD, and then we can write it in a more pleasing way, N equals N naught 2 to the KT, as long as we keep track of our definitions, where K is 1 over TD in this case. 2 is not such a common base, although nowadays it could be. So let's say we use 10, because we use 10 a lot, like natural log is 10, right? So we can also express it as N equals N naught 10 to the kt, but it's a different k here. This prime is only, because the k just depends on your definition, so you'll never see this k prime in any textbook. I'm just using it here to distinguish it from this k. Here, the k prime is not 1 over td, but the log base 10, log, of 2 over td, rather than 1 over td. So we can write yet another equation. Like this, or we can take any other base. We could use 3. That's not silly, right? But we could use e, the natural log, and in that case, k is the natural log of 2, because it's binary fission, divided by td. If we took the log of both sides of this equation, we bring n over here, and we have the log of n over n naught equals the log of this one. We're doing the 10 one, right? The log of 10 to the kt, which is just kt. Right? So we have this relationship, and we see that as time goes by, the fold increase in the number of cells goes by the log. Right? This log of 2 is a constant, right? About 0.3. Okay, I'm 1 minute over. Let's see if we can get... This is just the other case. I think we can take 30 seconds more. Here's what the exponential growth looks like. You start with one E. coli cell. You see nothing for hours on this scale. And then shoots up. That's exponential growth, right, for T. If you would plot it more reasonably on a semi-log plot, where this is the log of N, or you could put the actual numbers in here, the same numbers, but on a log plot, each mark is a decade, right? Then you see the log of n over n naught, right, is equal to just kt, where the slope of this line is k. Here's t going along there. Most of this you can get from looking at the exponential growth handout, and in fact it's almost necessary because it's too quick to absorb here. So we'll start with those molecules of the cell next time.